Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Nancy Horan, whose book, Loving Frank, is about the relationship between Mamma Barthwick Cheney and Frank Lloyd Wright from 1907 to 1914, a time when there isn't that much research about the early life of Frank Lloyd Wright. We don't know that much about it, and we know very, very little about her. Let's start by talking about what drew you to this as your first novel. You lived in Oak Park in Illinois, which was just down the block from where Frank Lloyd Wright lived and where Mamma Cheney lived before they got together, right?
Right. Actually, I lived on East Avenue. Frank Lloyd Wright had built a house in 1903 for Edwin Cheney and his wife Mamma Borthwick Cheney. And it was on East Avenue also. So I would walk by that house regularly, recognizing it as a Frank Lloyd Wright house, but not knowing that it was her house. And people, surprisingly, don't entirely know the story of his relationship with her, even folks in Oak Park. Frank Lloyd Wright's architecture and his legacy is part of the culture there, however. His own home and studio was not that far from her home, but it draws tons of tourists every year. People walk around Oak Park in headphones and listen to tapes about his work and observe his architecture.
In those tours, those self-guided tours, that house is shown to be a Frank Lloyd Wright house, so people pass it and they go, aha, but they don't necessarily make the connection that this was his mistress.
Right, and also, often people start their touring of Oak Park at Frank Lloyd Wright's home and studio, which he built for his family. He built his home for Catherine, his young wife, and they eventually had six children, and he lived there and had his studio there and worked there for the beginning of his career. So when you tour that facility, you experience Wright's values, which are family values. His architecture celebrates family values. And then you learn that it's been restored to the year 1909. And if anybody asks why he left in 1909, the awkward truth comes out, and that is that he left Oak Park in the company of a woman who was his ex-client and who, you know, was his lover.
You'd heard the story, so you knew vaguely about this woman, Mamma Cheney. But at what point did you suddenly stop and go, whoa, something's off here, and I'm curious?
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's hard to pinpoint when I realized that it was a story that I needed to write, but I was interested in writing fiction. I was taking fiction and writing classes at University of Chicago, but I think little details came at me. For example, there's a big Victorian that stands next to the Cheney House in Oak Park, which is a typical prairie house of Wright's. It's low-slung brick house. And I noticed that there was a boarded-up window in that house next door. As I learned details about this story of Wright's love affair with Mamma Cheney, I came upon a memoir called Memories of Four Sisters that was written by a woman who grew up in that house next to the Cheney house. And she recalled standing on a luggage cart in a bedroom closet on the second floor of this big Victorian, and with her sisters being able to look down into the curtainless windows of the Cheney house. And she indicated the children could see Frank and Mamma making love. What that meant in those days is hard to guess. I mean, it might have meant spooning. On the other hand, it might have meant making love. It's hard to say. That was just one of the interesting pieces of research that I found during the process of pursuing the story. But the moment when it came to me, I can't really say, but it was probably in 1999, and I started writing it from four points of view, actually. I wrote it from Catherine Wright's point of view because I felt enormous sympathy for her, left in the lurch with six children. I wrote it also from Mamma's point of view. And Marion Mahoney, the architect, the female architect who worked for Frank Lloyd Wright, who later in her life felt very underappreciated by Wright. I was aiming for a woman's perspective on Wright, these multiple women. And then the fourth was a child who lived next door to the Cheney house, kind of based on that memoir. Ultimately, I found that multiple points of view was not working for me. It presented a distance that I couldn't seem to get over. I knew I was avoiding some questions. My big problem with using Mae Mazzini as the main point of view was that she had done something that seemed very difficult to have a heroine do in a story. She had left her children, abandoned her children for a lover. Yet it was the question that kind of haunted me about her, because I had these conflicting descriptions of her. I had, on one hand, headlines that said she was a vampire, and on the other hand, contemporary accounts in newspapers from friends described her as a lovely woman, highly refined and educated woman, a good woman, a noble woman. So who was she? You know, this was the thing. And once I realized that I was avoiding those questions, I went straight into her point of view.
What seems to come out, and maybe it's the only way to write it, is that to some degree, her sensibility is the sensibility of someone from 100 years later.
Oh, that's an interesting point. Her sensibility, I think, was ahead of her time, to be sure. But I felt that to tell the story from her point of view meant not to judge her. To crawl inside her skin and tell her story as she might have explained it would be the only way to do it.
And you chose consciously to stick as close to every single fact. I think in one piece I read, you said you fudged on when Frank Lloyd Wright gave a speech, but not much more than that. You stuck directly to it, and you found that liberating.
Absolutely liberating, because it had happened. Now, I didn't have a full account, and there were such big gaps. There was great room for imagining. But when you're presented with facts about choices that were made, you're looking at something that really happened, and then you examine what was the thought process in that, or the lack of thought. And what I started to see was this cascade of choices. I don't think there initially was a great big choice to abandon the families and leave for 2 years. And, you know, I don't think it was a clearly set out plan that they left with. It may have been impulsive that they went off together. At that point, I should point out that Frank Lloyd Wright's marriage had been rocky for a while, possibly because of his involvement with Mae Mazzini for a long time. I can't say when the affair really began. I'm guessing 07.
You kind of hedged that by starting afterward and then kind of flashing back to
right.
The fact that it was already happening.
Right. Well, if he built the house in 03, obviously sparks flew between Mae and Frank. She was the woman of the house who was working closely with him.
And she was a beautiful woman.
Beautiful woman. And he has been called a ladies' man over the years. I have no evidence that he was having affairs with other women. But in any case, they obviously reached an understanding. But Mae had a child in 1905 by Edwin. So my guess is that if there was an attraction, it abated for a while. She was again involved in her marriage, but by 1907, I think that they were involved once more.
In order to get into her head, it meant dealing with what a woman's life was like, and particularly what a feminist, because it's pretty clear that Mae is a feminist, from her own writings, from the material you later found. When you began writing it, was it as clear as it later became?
No. I had read that she had translated for a Swedish feminist, so I got a sense that she probably had those leanings. There's no evidence to suggest that she was active in the suffrage movement, but she was a member of women's clubs. She was a member of the 19th century women's club, and in those days, those clubs were for women as much as social outlets, they were to educate each other. Mae delivered papers there on Goethe and Shakespeare. Catherine Wright was a member of that club. Ernest Hemingway's mother was a member of that club.
So it's conceivable, in fact, that Catherine Wright and Mae Mazzini knew each other better than you hint in the book.
They definitely did. They were friends. Certainly after Frank Lloyd Wright built that house for the Cheneys, they became part of a social circle, and that meant they were together quite a bit socially. So they were friends. That's even more of the pain and anguish that occurred at the time the affair happened.
At that particular time, how well known was Frank Lloyd Wright, and how solid were his ideas about architecture, do you think?
He was, I think, a man who was evolving his ideas about organic architecture. He was a young man. You know, we have this image of Frank Lloyd Wright with the white hair and the cane and the cape and the hat. And I think he was an eccentric dresser all of his life. But I think he was a man who was finding his way still. He was certainly well known around the Chicago area and the Midwest, but his reputation was nothing like it is today. I mean, he was at the beginning of his career.
And the feminism of the time was a little different. We have the mix of being a good mother, suffrage, and something you don't talk about, but it was clear in the 20s suffrage movement, temperance. Prohibition and suffrage actually did kind of come together.
Well, those had been together, certainly, at the turn of the century, too. You had many factions in the woman movement, and the term feminism was not really used much in this country around the time that MAMA was the subject of this big scandal. The unifying focus for many different groups of women was the vote, and that was the unifying thing that brought them together. There was a new wave of thinking, however. It celebrated the individual. And that was the feminism that was changing the woman movement at that time, around 1910. The essence of it was that women were more than simply nurturers. They deserved to realize their personalities, to realize their potential and their gifts. That came in conflict a bit with some people who were just very much interested in vote and equal pay for equal work.
Nancy Horan, okay, you decide you're going to work on this book. You didn't know too much. I guess early on you found books like Frank Lloyd Wright, The Lost Years.
Oh, that was very important. Anthony Alefson's wonderful book that really does the early and best research about this period of Frank Lloyd Wright's life when he did lose years in a sense because he lost clients as a consequence of the scandal.
Wright himself, his own writings were pretty useless because he doesn't even talk about her in his autobiography.
He does actually talk about her.
Okay.
He does. He mentions her name, I think, only once, though. But he describes the period of time they spent together in Germany and also especially in Italy. They had a very idyllic summer in 1910 in Italy. He called her faithful comrade. And when you think about what she meant to him, I think that he saw her as a peer. Ultimately, when he built Taliesin for her and he conducted business in Chicago and had to leave Wisconsin, he put her in charge of the workroom. He trusted her that much. So I think he saw in her a companion, a fellow adventurer. He talked about their departure for Europe as a spiritual adventure. And I found a book in the collection of Catherine and Frank Lloyd Wright's library, and it was called Spiritual Adventures. And ultimately, what it was a short story collection about people going out and seeing the world through new eyes. And that's what he needed.
Did you find any resistance from the Wright people in terms of writing the book, or did they open up everything to you?
I did not want to be influenced by the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation or the people who have preserved his legacy, and I wanted to write my own book. Consequently, I went to the Getty Archive to read his correspondence rather than going to Taliesin West, because I wanted to write the book that I imagined and without being influenced. That said, since then, the book has been embraced to the point where the book is sold at Taliesin West. I don't know that it's universally embraced, but the fact is it's being sold at Taliesin West and also at Taliesin in Wisconsin and certainly at the home and studio. I think they're realists about this period of his life, and so much has been written about Wright that is controversial anyway. He's been called so many terms, an egotist, a narcissist, impossibly arrogant. So this is not something that surprises or embarrasses anybody now.
Mama Cheney, you've mentioned on your website that you believe she had a huge influence on Wright's work. And I could see that because of the nature of their relationship, as we know from this historical record. But have you been able to put your finger on anything where you could say, I think that might have come from her?
Part of his idea about organic architecture was not only that it relate to the environment, that it used natural materials, but that it suit its inhabitants. And he built Taliesin for her. He called her Mema of the Garden, Mema of the Hills. She obviously loved nature too. Taliesin in Wisconsin has terraces that, to me, are reminiscent of the Italian villas that they experienced together when they were in Fiesole. There are those things. Now, of course, Wright was always concerned and interested in connecting the indoors and the outdoors. So it was just a sympathetic feeling in Italy that he found there for the kind of architecture he loved, I think, that indoor-outdoor experience. I think what she gave him was space. I think that he felt very confined by his circumstances at the time he left Oak Park. He wrote to his patron, Darwin Martin, "It is difficult for me to square my life with myself, and I cannot rest until it is done or I am dead." He was stuck. He didn't know what he was looking for. He just knew that he needed to get away. He went to Germany at the invitation of Ernst Wasmuth to put together an important portfolio that became a text for the great European architects, the modern architects of the time. So it was an important moment for him to put together his work and to become better known. And I think she helped him have the mental space to be free to do that.
Was there any jump in his architectural images, what he created between before he left for Europe and afterward, that you know of?
His imagery, his style, you know, I fear I will get into trouble by trying to comment on changes in his architecture. One thing that did happen when he went to Taliesin, he called it his first truly organic house, and it is built into the brow of the hill. Taliesin means shining brow. One thing that's different about his architecture in that building as opposed to the prairie houses in Oak Park is that he wasn't using the stained glass windows anymore, the decorative screens of leaded glass. He used clear panes of glass there. That was an innovation and a change for him, and it certainly meant that there was a greater connection between the landscape and the home.
You're listening to an interview with Nancy Horan, whose novel is Loving Frank, and Frank is Frank Lloyd Wright. In terms of your research, at what point did you realize that you were going to need to do research on Ellen Key, K-E-Y, the Swedish feminist?
Well, I knew she existed, and I knew that Mema had been translating her work, I thought perhaps before she went to Europe. I had been constructing Mema's character for a year or two when I came upon an internet reference to an article by a Scandinavian art scholar who indicated there was a cache of letters written by Mema Borthwick Cheney to Ellen Key in the Swedish Royal Library. I sent away for those letters and had copies sent to me. They were in English. They were in Mema's handwriting. And they dealt primarily with the business of translating, but they revealed to me where Mema was during that time and here and there how she was feeling about the choices she had made, how she felt about Frank Lloyd Wright. She regarded Ellen Key as a mentor, almost as a mother figure. The letters revealed to me where Mema was living. I arranged the letters chronologically, and I found that on the first letter, there was her address on Schaeferstrasse. So I got my hands on a Baedeker's 1908 guide, and it had these fragile maps that you could open out, and I discovered that she was living very close to Café de Weston, which was where modernist artists and poets were hanging out in those days. Berlin was alive with modernism. That quickly made its way into the book. These letters were kind of a window into Mema's soul at that point. And she was very, very, very much under the spell of Ellen Key's philosophy.
Was there any reference to whether she actually had met Elsa Lasker Schuller?
No. Elsa Lasker Schuller wrote beautiful poetry, and I thought she must go in here. And here's the other thing. I mean, sometimes you just respond to something, and it has to go into your book, such as the opera And I didn't even understand why I was putting that scene into the book. But I went to see Mephistopheles, and Mamie and Frank go to see Mephistopheles. I went to see it in Chicago with Samuel Raimi, and I was knocked out. I thought, this is just so fabulous. She could have seen it. And I sent them to the opera. Well, of course, it's the Faust story. It's about a man who sells his soul to the devil so he can say, for one brief moment, I was alive. It was Mamie's story. But my unconscious kind of led me there.
As you're working on it and you found these letters, you were actually able to read Mamie's voice. What was the relationship? Was there any relationship between the voice that you'd concocted for her and her real one?
It was a close relationship.
Really?
I was happy to find. Yeah, I felt a great sense of affirmation when I found that, because there was that voice. I had been writing letters by Mamie, and my writing group, happily, couldn't tell which was Mamie's letter and which were my letters. So I did include one paragraph from Mamie's letter to Ellen Kay about her relationship with Frank Lloyd Wright. So there is a real piece of Mamie's letter in there.
Was she seriously disillusioned with Kay, as your book suggests?
She was frustrated. I could tell in her letters. Basically, what happened was Ellen Kay had conflicting philosophies. On one hand, she espoused free love in the sense that a loveless marriage was immoral, and a loving relationship that was not sanctioned by a marriage certificate could be very moral. So Mamie undoubtedly responded to that strongly. And the other interesting thing is that she found Kay's philosophy in Europe. The letters revealed that to me. She hadn't been translating her before. But it became her goal to be the translator for Ellen Kay and bring that thinking to the United States. So that line of philosophical thinking very much appealed to her. On the other hand, Ellen Kay believed in a culture of love, and she had the long term in mind. She imagined the human race evolving to a point where institutions would be based on love. She felt that a woman should absolutely realize her gifts and her potential, but then she should exercise them in the home and in the nursery as the educators of children and the people who would shape the human race. And so she didn't really envision most women working outside the home. She didn't champion that.
She also wouldn't have championed a woman walking away from her children.
Right. She didn't feel that that superseded the needs of the children. On the other hand, she would say a great love has its own rights and should be paid attention to. So Mamie undoubtedly considered her love with Frank Lloyd Wright to be that.
The newspapers of the time, you give excerpts, but in some of the accompanying material that I received, you could see the newspapers and the articles. That's a lot more powerful than reading them in the book. First of all, there are lies. The wife of his best friend, that was not Frank Lloyd Wright's best friend, was it?
I doubt it. But at the same time, they were friends. I don't think they were best friends. That's an exaggeration.
There's a huge amount of judgmental statements being made, and the way you describe how the press hounds them, coming up to Taliesin and trying to sneak in, people standing outside trying to take pictures, is that all what happened?
I think they were very much harassed by the press. At the same time, Frank Lloyd Wright entered a kind of dance with the press. He initiated things that he probably should have avoided. For example, calling a press conference on Christmas Day in 1911 to explain himself, because they had been discovered at Taliesin, and he was dressed in a red robe, supposedly. She apparently was dressed in a kimono. And they were presenting themselves as this happy couple at Taliesin. I don't know how wise that was.
That press conference is almost verbatim then in your book?
It is, yes.
The judgmental material in these articles sounds more like Fox News and the kind of judgments they present than even opinion pieces in the newspapers. It's very, very judgmental.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you. I had those news reports to look at, and I kind of had to work backwards and imagine, how did this play out?
At what point did you realize that these were very, very unreliable narrators?
I saw inconsistencies. I mean, you know, one newspaper would copy the other newspaper and use the same kind of information. There was one account in particular that was very painful to read, and I could tell it was invented completely. And that was supposedly an interview with Lizzie, Mamie's sister, in which she talks about how disappointed she is in her sister. It is so unnatural in its quotes. No one talked the way they supposedly quoted Lizzie as speaking. So I knew that it had been invented, and yet they had snooped around and gotten bits of information, the school where the children went to school, that sort of thing. It was interesting.
In looking at the book after you've finished, you've said that you can begin seeing similarities between women's struggles today and women's struggles then. What do you think of the greatest similarity, and also, what do you think is the greatest difference?
The greatest difference is that young women today have far more opportunities. I tend to think that we're a bit more tolerant of people's private choices. On the other hand, I see similarities in the sense that women struggle even today with this whole idea of fulfilling themselves as mothers and also fulfilling their potential as working women. This was a conflict that women were experiencing in those days very strongly, and it doesn't change. And what was really interesting was finding Ellen Kay's opinion about the whole thing. Of course, she envisioned most women staying at home and using their gifts there. However, she saw women artists as a separate category, sort of almost a superior category of women. And she said those women were really going to have a hard time with that conflict. And frankly, there was no resolution to this conflict. So here we are, 100 years later, and I'd have to say, is there a real resolution for this conflict? I think every woman struggles with this issue of having it all, or having it in the proper sequence or something, you know, balancing it properly. And I do think of some of those women, those feminists in the early, you know, in the 1910s were so interesting and so out there and really proposing changes like social adaptations to kind of accommodate women. Today, I think it's a much more personal journey for a lot of women. I think they work it out in their own heads.
Nancy Horan, before we went on the air, you mentioned that toward the end of the writing of the book, I guess it was, you found out about these photos and you were able to incorporate material from the photos, looking at the photos, into the business of describing the creation of Taliesin. How did those photos come to you?
I actually read about them on the internet. Apparently, an album of photographs surfaced on eBay, and there was a group of Wright fans in Wisconsin and historians who put their resources together and bid on it and got that scrapbook. And that became part of, you know, Wisconsin's Historical Society, I think, some historical group in Wisconsin. A gentleman wrote an article about it, and I saw the pictures. The pictures were from 1911. They could have been taken by Mamie Borthwick because they were taken during construction. The construction workers are in there, the masons and the workmen who worked with Wright. It just instantly went into the book as Mamie being the photographer. That was the joy of research. I mean, that's the big secret that historians keep to themselves, is that it's great to go and just follow a theme and do your own research. I loved it.
You've said that you wrote the ending of the book while you were working on the middle of the book. Is that correct?
Right. I mean, the way the writing process worked for me, I don't know how it works for other people, but some chapters were written out of sequence. I knew certain parts that had to be there. The opera scene had to be there. The ending scene needed to be there. The opening would change. But by the middle of my process, you know, a 7-year process of writing and researching, I wrote the ending of the book.
Was it fun to actually work on something instead of being the scrounging freelance article writer?
Oh, well, it was just a personal passion. I had no idea if it was going to end up being published. Because I had never published fiction before, it was a crapshoot. I didn't know. And so, you know, it was kind of a lonely, isolated journey. I was taking freelance assignments on the side, taking little jobs here and there, and just pursuing this thing because this story took a hold of me and just shook me up. It shook me around. I had to tell this story, and however I had to do it, I was going to do it. And it took a couple of different versions of it to make it happen.
And you're happy with the fact that you did this working inside a writing group that includes Elizabeth Berg, who was a guest on this program a few weeks ago.
I didn't find the writing group until about my fourth year into the project. I was invited to join a writing group. Elizabeth was one of the two women who started it. And altogether, there were five of us, very different kinds of writers, a young adult novelist, Elizabeth Berg, myself, a professor from Northwestern who was writing about front-page journalism post-9/11. I mean, you know, we were doing different kinds of work in another woman. But what was great about it was that we had deadlines. We met every week. We came with pages. And we read aloud our work to each other. We critiqued each other. We either accepted the criticism or forgot about it. Each of us was confident enough to pick and choose what we wanted to hear.
But you were all professionals. It wasn't people who were just starting out and, you know, going, what does this sound like?
Right. Everybody had published a book before, but I was new to fiction. So, you know, it was interesting. I was very lucky to find these people. We knew each other's characters very well.
Nancy Horan, did you always plan on being a writer?
No. I was an English major. I taught English, taught reading. I had lots of different jobs over the years. But my instinct to write a novel or write stories really comes from having a childhood where storytelling was very much valued. And nothing was better than sitting around the dining room table and having my aunts regale us with hilarious stories about the old relatives who lived out in the country or whatever. And I think everybody in my family is a storyteller. And it was the story that pulled me through. It was always the story with this novel. I knew that this was an extraordinary story in its outline, and it needed to be fully told.
They say that for most writers, there's that one book that they were always meaning to write. Sometimes it's the fourth or fifth. Frequently, it's the first. In this case, it sounds like the first, which means that once the book is written, what then?
Once the book is written, you don't know if you're a novelist until you've written a novel. The only way to do it is to do it. And it sounds so simple and stupidly obvious, but you can talk a lot about writing. But unless you do it, you don't know if you're capable of it. Well, I did it. So now I know I could do it again, I think.
Have you started looking around for ideas? Has anything grabbed you yet?
A couple of things. I've written scenes. I've written vignettes. That's how it begins. I've certainly started to research. So there are a couple of different directions, historical directions.
Any word from Hollywood on this story yet?
You know, there have been little nibbles here and there, but it has not been bought as a film. No, no film rights have been bought yet, as far as I know.
Are you still doing freelance writing?
No, I'm not.
You're just focusing now on this?
On fiction. The best outcome of this whole thing is just the joy of writing fiction. I love it. It's a great thing.
You've been listening to an interview with Nancy Horan, whose novel is Loving Frank, about Frank Lloyd Wright and Mamah Borthwick Cheney. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.